What's up, everybody? Welcome to the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Today is the Friday edition where we talk about finance stuff. And I've got a special treat for us today. I've got Sim joining me, my favorite person on the team.
Hi.
Don't tell anybody. And I've got actually our famous podcast editor, Steve, joining us as well. Oh my goodness. Welcome, Steve.
Thanks for having me. Finally.
Steve is literally who edits our podcast episodes. The joke, like for all of us who have ever done a podcast with Student Loan Planner or for the Friday episodes, is whenever we mess up, it's, sorry, Steve, we love you.
That's his name in my head. Sorry, Steve, TM.
It's not just Steve, it's sorry, Steve.
I'll start all my social channel names with that now. Sorry, Steve is my Twitter handle.
Oh my gosh. You totally could, yeah.
I could.
Yeah.
You heard it here first, everybody.
We did an episode a couple of weeks ago, maybe about a month ago, where Steve was, of course, listening because he's editing the episode. And he said, Megan, I've had a similar scenario. Like, I could talk about this with you. And I was like, I jumped straight on it. I was like, Steve, do you want to be on the podcast with me? And he said, yes. So we're going to talk about a couple different things today related to kind of end of the year planning. We touched on this a bit in one of our episodes about getting organized for tax season. But also, Steve has a really interesting story about his recent life change, right? Where you have moved, relocated your family to Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
You bought a home without credit, is what I understand. Is that right?
Yep.
What?
Without a traditional credit score, which I had been talking about for years, because if you look at, and you talked about this, Megan, you look at how a credit score is measured, it's very one-sided. You have to have debt products and debt in order to have a credit score.
Mm-hmm.
That's really a debt score.
Mm-hmm.
And I proved that I could get a really big honking loan, which was ridiculous, by the way, but there's more of a story about that, without that traditional score. I have not had a credit card, not even an open account since 2008.
Wow.
My wife and I paid off our mortgage from our St. Louis home in 2015. Mm-hmm. So as of 2017, I had nothing on my credit report. So they could not pull and create a credit score from the report. So I had the perfect credit score. It was zero.
Mm-hmm. So you pay everything in cash?
Yep. Cash and cash equivalents.
Debit.
Yep. Debit, check, cash. You know, you pay stuff online. It's pretty much your bank account.
Do you get worried at all about security with that? I think that's sometimes like what some folks will say is credit is easier to like shut off access to money if someone uses your card unauthorized, like steals your card number or something. But how do you feel about that?
I am not worried, because if you're using your debit card like a credit card, which means you're just swiping it and signing and you're not using mm-hmm. your PIN number, you have the exact same protections, the zero liability protections that a Visa credit card or a MasterCard credit card has.
Mm-hmm.
And I could point to the documents that have been on those websites, MasterCard and Visa, that's been on their websites for almost a decade now, saying debit cards have the same liability. Now, if somebody gets out there and is using your PIN number, yes, you're kind of out of luck. I don't know what your bank will do to work with you, but this has been my experience. I've had, in this household, we've had three debit cards compromised. The first one, my bank called me and said, hey, are you getting a hotel room at the Bellagio? I'm like, no, we're in Missouri today. That's not me. I'm like, okay, we're going to shut off your card. We're going to refund the money. And I had to fill out a form and fax it in. Whoopee.
Mm-hmm.
A couple other times, same kind of scenario. One was my wife's personal debit card, and somebody had used it at a gas station on a Friday night to buy diesel. It was certainly not my wife at the time. So we had that canceled and everything. But then we have a family member who has a credit card, and she had called the credit card company and said, hey, I got this $30 charge on my account from this auto store.
Mm-hmm.
The credit card company would not stand behind their own zero liability policy.
Oh, no.
And that's when I realized our banks want to really work and keep our accounts and keep us happy. Whereas a credit card company, they're kind of a disassociated party and they don't really care as much. They do care, but they don't care as much because it was only a $30 charge and they don't want to go through that. I don't know what it was, but I was like, okay, I'm sticking with my plan. I'm not changing it for anything.
That's so interesting, Steve, because I have had two disputed charges with my credit card company, and they handled it like very easily. I don't know if it's because I got a good rep. One of them was for some makeup that took 3 weeks to ship and they didn't even like talk to me. And so I called the rep and we were just like gossiping about makeup. And I was like, oh, honey, like don't do that color. And I don't know, maybe that's why they gave me my money back.
I can't say I've had that experience. Yeah.
Do you have a local credit union for your bank, or do you have one of the big mega banks?
We have one of the larger banks, not one of the big ones, but we've been with the same bank for a while. But I've heard the same story from other people. In fact, so I used to have a podcast. I retired it in 2015. And one of the episodes I did was asking people who also have had their cards compromised, you know, what their experiences were. And over the years since then, I've asked the same question. Have you lost money due to your card being compromised? And not a single person has told me they've actually lost money with their debit card being compromised. So the myth, I'm going to call it a myth, that a credit card is safer than a debit card, I just can't see any, I don't see any proof to that. The debit card has been just as safe as credit card as far as a zero liability policy there. And with a debit card, it's really hard to get into debt.
You don't have any FOMO with like missing out on cash back rewards or travel points?
Now you're going to get into some real heavy stuff that people are not going to like me talking about. It's just like recently how Bruce Willis came out and said that, you know, Die Hard is not a Christmas movie. People are not going to listen to anybody that says anything differently. Mm-hmm. I don't use credit because of a bunch of different reasons. One of them is I'm supposed to treat my neighbor like myself. It's biblically scriptural. Mm-hmm. I also was a coach and I was teaching people how to get out of debt, not get into debt. And when you're using a credit card, the processing fees that are charged to the vendor are higher than for people who are paying with cash, check, or even debit.
That's true. Yeah.
So if I'm going to the grocery store and using my credit card to get points, I'm increasing the fees that the vendor has to pay. And guess what? The vendor's not just going to sit there and eat it. They're going to raise their rates. They're going to raise their prices. Mm-hmm. So if everybody in my town was using cash and I was using credit, I'm increasing the cost of the vendor. They're going to have to raise the rates on the price on the shelf. I can't do that. I just don't feel right about that.
That reminds me of that episode of The Good Place. If you haven't seen it, great show. And they were talking about how hard it is to be like an ethical consumer, like even something as simple as like buying a tomato. Okay, well, who grew the tomato and in what conditions were those workers treated and what were your agricultural practices? Like it is so hard to do the right thing when you're trying to do something as simple as like just build credit.
Mm-hmm. Well said. So it's a personal choice of mine, but I do think that a lot of other people would probably feel the same way if they realized what was happening. Because one thing you're now seeing more and more at the registers, you'll be charged a 3% fee if you use a credit card.
I saw that.
I have been seeing more of that. And in different states, it's more prevalent. I feel like Georgia has not gotten to that point where I live, but I have traveled to states where you're charged for the bag, you're charged for plastic, you're charged, could be the processing fee. And restaurants, actually, I think in Georgia, restaurants are starting to have the processing fee tacked on to like the meal ticket, if you're looking at the receipt. So maybe it hasn't started in grocery stores for us, but it started at certain restaurants for sure, especially in like downtown, I've noticed.
Yeah, so now it's becoming more visible to everybody about these processing fees, that there's a cost of doing business for using that plastic versus cash, check, or debit. And a lot of stores now even just process the debit card as credit by default. So you don't get that advantage there. I mean, you're going to get, it's going to be handled just like a credit card, which means it's going to be processed through the same system. That processing fee is going to be the same as a credit card. So I am kind of stuck in that area, but I have never had a problem buying stuff online. I've only once had a problem renting a car. I can get a hotel room.
That's what I was going to ask.
Yeah.
What about like rentals or hotels or things like that? Like where they want like a card or like a credit.
Yeah.
Well, they make it sound like they want a credit card. So maybe they don't always or they don't have to.
Well, the one caveat we have to have here is if you're using your debit card and you're not going to have a credit card like me, then you've got to have some cash in the bank account because they're going to run some pre-authorizations, which means they're going to hold funds aside, which means if other charges come in at the same time, you're going to go in overdraft and you don't want that to happen.
That makes sense. So you would have to have a cash buffer.
Yeah. You have a cash buffer, then you're not going to worry about that. In fact, a long time ago, I told myself that 1,000 is the new zero. If I have $1,000 in my bank account, I'm not going to ever overdraft. So 1,000 was what I wanted to balance at. No less ever. Never go below that four-digit number. And it's worked out pretty well.
Gotcha.
Okay. So Steve, what Jedi tricks did you use then to get a mortgage without a credit score?
There you go. This is the magic, right? Well, okay, so there's always that manual underwriting process, which is expensive and timely, very time-consuming for a bank. So I understand why they want to go with a credit score because it's easy to pull a report, look at the things, find that three-digit number. Yes, you're approved. No, you're not approved. Got us into a lot of trouble in 2008, 2009, didn't it? Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't have a credit score, so how do you get a loan? I'm a single-income household. My wife doesn't work. She hasn't worked since September 2021, thank goodness. I'm self-employed, which is another ding if you're trying to get a mortgage.
Yeah, makes it a little complicated.
Yep.
That's already tough, even if you like have a credit score. Just to be self-employed is another layer of complexity.
Yep. So I didn't go through manual underwriting. What I did was use some other tools, some third-party tools out there to show that I was credit-worthy. So there's a company called eCredible. Disclaimer, I've been an affiliate of theirs for over a decade. Mm-hmm. This is a service where you can go in and you register your bills. I'm not talking about your debts, but your bills, like your electric bill. You could put in your gas bill. You can put in your cell phone, even your insurance, things like that. And they will verify that you're actually making payments to these companies, and they will report that.
Oh.
So you're showing on your credit report things that would never show up there unless you stop paying things. Mm-hmm. And you never want to stop paying something just so it'll show up on your credit report. That would be a bad thing.
Yeah.
So I had our Verizon cell phone bill. We had our Spectrum internet on there. We had a few things. So that would show a trend of history of payments. So it shows that, hey, this guy isn't a deadbeat. He's not paying his bills. He's actually paying his bills on time.
Right. Which actually is the biggest, like we talked about in our Credit 101 episode, it's the biggest factor of your credit score, if you have a score, is on time, in full monthly payments. That's 35% of what makes up somebody's credit score. And so companies care about that. And that's going to that, you know, what is it? Beating that drum there is going ahead and showing like, hey, yeah, I do. Kind of like you said, I'm not a deadbeat. I do have payments and I do make those payments on time. Here, I'll show you.
So it's kind of like a manual underwriting process, but it's a third party verification system that's already in place. And you're not just showing up and hey, I'm going to get a mortgage tomorrow. I need to do this. But you know, a few months ahead, prove that you've got that pattern of paying your bills.
So in true millennial fashion, I can't have a conversation without Googling something that I don't know about. So I'm already on their website and it looks like they have two subscription options.
Okay. I was going to say, what does it cost?
there's the basic version, eCredible Lift, and then there's Lift Locker. So the basic version is $9.95 a month. And then the advanced version is $14.95, which includes the services that Steve just mentioned. Looks like they also do like some cash flow analysis, like a little budgeting tool as well. But looks like the basic service is $9.95.
Gotcha. Does that sound familiar? Is that what it is for you still? Or are you locked into some really nice
rate? I'm actually locked into an old plan, so it's not that expensive for me. But it's probably going to be cheaper than if I were paying interest on a credit card that I couldn't pay off. Because I know myself well enough to say I would have a brand new MacBook Pro sitting here with the M4 chip that I wouldn't be able to pay cash for, and I would be paying interest on it if I wasn't living this cash lifestyle.
That's a big part of this too, is using credit psychologically. Like a lot of people talk about this, how it is just different. It's not seeing your balance go down when you're spending. It's a kind of an invisible barrier where that's a card. Mentally, you're not thinking about it as money. You do charge stuff on it and the balance goes up, but like psychologically, it doesn't hit the same way as money going down in your checking account. So I could see that, and I could see using debit solely, switching over to debit, kind of axing all the credit cards, being very advantageous to people who do have like a compulsive problem with spending, or they treat themselves a little too much. Like, nothing wrong with treating yourself, but there's limits to everything. So that could be a good proactive way to just know yourself and prevent yourself from going into debt. And I think a lot of people are scared to maybe take that step one, because everybody says, no, you have to have credit. I think even we've said like credit. I know I use credit cards. I think you do, Sim. We use them responsibly though.
Pay them in full every month.
Yeah, but I think some people might be scared to take that change or make that already hard change to create that really good habit, because maybe a lot of the financial space says like, no, it's not possible, but you're saying it is. So I love this conversation. This is really great.
Yeah. When I first cut up all my credit cards, I was a little bit scared. Actually, what I did first was I took them and I put them away for 6 months and I wasn't going to use them. I said, I can do this. I don't need a credit card. I was sick and fed up with debt and I was like, I'm done. And 6 months later, I'm like, why do I still have these? So I went ahead and cut them up, closed the accounts. But we also were a little more confident because we had that now that 6 month history. Plus, we had ourselves in a position where we had an emergency fund. So we had savings on the side. So if something were to happen, we don't pull out the credit card to pay for the car repair. We took out the cash. Mm-hmm. And that sets that stability pattern where from then on, I was just like, okay, we're now growing our net worth instead of going up and down, spending and paying off debt with a credit card.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Okay. So you use this service to help build some kind of history of mm-hmm. showing on-time payments. And then you went through a manual underwriting process with the mortgage company. Okay.
No, there was no manual underwriting. That's the beauty of it, is the Ecredible. So there's actually two ways that you can prove creditworthiness. One is Ecredible, and that reports to TransUnion, which a lot of places use. Mm-hmm. If you're looking for a free version, Experian Boost is similar. Mm-hmm. It's a free version. Now, they tie into your bank account, which is a little bit scary. You know, they're going to tie into your bank account, and they're going to identify, okay, here, his electric bill is paid every month, his cell phone bill every month, whatever. And they're going to include that. But that's a free way to get a credit. I'm going to call it a credit worthiness score. It still shows up like a credit score. Mm-hmm. By the way, remember, 2017, I had nothing on my credit report. Mm-hmm. And so I start using Ecredible to build this faux credit. And I had a 749 when we applied for this loan, which everybody says is a really good score. I didn't know. I didn't care because I was never going to borrow again until we we decided to move and we needed this mortgage. Mm-hmm. So even just based on credit history of a cell phone bill, electric bill, and internet cable, mm-hmm. I was able to get a 749. I mean, come on. That beats a lot of what people are saying out there, is like, you got to manage your mix of credits and your utilization of those cards. And that's way too complicated. I want to simplify my life. I just said, I'll just show that I can pay my bills on time with this service. And that was it.
So you know I'm already on their website. I'm looking at Experian Boost. This is fascinating what they'll let you include. So it has the utility payments, but it also says video streaming services.
Sure.
And they'll accept insurance payments like home insurance, homeowners, auto, life, etc., as long as it's paid monthly.
Mm-hmm. So Netflix.
That's neat.
Netflix right there. Yeah. Discovery Plus, you know, all that, Disney Plus, Apple Plus, all the pluses.
Which everybody pretty much inevitably has these days.
There's some version. Cable. You have at least one.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. So do you think, and I don't know the answer to this, and you may not either, but do you think someone with bad credit or someone who's trying to like rebuild their credit, adding this and kind of slowing down their credit usage could help them maybe improve their credit faster?
Absolutely. In fact, that's one of the pitching points from Experian in these places, say you bolster or boost your, Experian boost your score mm-hmm. by adding these additional, and rent, of course, rent is the thing that I think there's some changes in the industry now that more places who rent are reporting, or there are services out there that make it easier to report your rent. But I mean, it fits within that Experian Boost and the Ecredible model. So it's all there with the other things that you want to report as well to boost your score or replace your traditional credit score with the stuff that's not debt.
That's really, I love this conversation. It's really fascinating because mm-hmm. I think a lot of folks do also kind of like your question, Sim, like they get caught up in like missing out on points or travel miles or whatever it is. I think the downside to that is a lot of people overspend trying to reach those thresholds sometimes, or they don't quite understand exactly how the program works and they don't spend, either they don't spend enough or they don't spend enough during the right time frame, or they don't use it in time. Like there's a lot of things that kind of those credit card companies are probably hoping that you miss out on or that you like don't fully understand and that you don't get to take advantage of, to where is it worth all the effort for those minute benefits when you could have maybe more peace of mind and knowing like, nope, you know, I'm sticking to a budget. I'm sticking to a really healthy emergency reserve. I'm preventing any kind of debt in the future. And I'm just going to live that way, like that different kind of lifestyle. I guess that's the kind of craziest coming out of my mouth. Like that's a different lifestyle compared to what the average American.
But it is though.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
Wait, so Steve, do you still like, even though you don't have credit, do you still check your credit reports to make sure no one's like trying to open stuff in your name?
That's exactly right. The importance of checking your report is, I mean, mandatory, because there are going to be times, even if you freeze your credit, there's a possibility that someone's going to open up an account under your name. They're not supposed to be able to, but they can, just because not all these places check. So I will check my reports on a regular basis. In the old days, I used to do it every quarter. You know, usually every 4 months, you used to rotate one different place every 4 months. But now it seems like it's almost permanent now. You could actually check it weekly at, and Megan, you talked about this before, at annualcreditreport.com. No charge. Mm-hmm. So you can see your report there. It'll tell you all your credit history. It won't give you your score. But again, I don't care about my score. I want to show that I'm credit worthy, or I want to make sure here with the report that nothing weird is going on.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Yeah. And that was one of the takeaways from one of those episodes was freeze your credit if you're not planning on using it anytime soon to make sure that no one's using it before you can check it, before you're regularly timed to check it. You know, there was someone on our team who went through like an identity theft situation that started with something on their credit. And it is very complicated to try to, I don't even know how to say it. Like, it's not getting out of that situation. It's remedying that situation once that's happened. Because if someone has access to your, let's say your social security number, for example, then they can do a lot with that. And that was something that he had to deal with and monitor for a really long time. And I think tax-wise, Sim, you would know this. Don't you have to have like a PIN number or some kind of...
You can get like an IP PIN, like an identity protection PIN, which I think more and more tax preparers are asking their clients to get anyway out of an abundance of caution.
And what does that do exactly from like the tax preparer side and then from the client side?
When you're doing like tax preparation, at least in the software, you have to enter a PIN for signature. And so this one is like a PIN that's not like your social or something. It's separated from you.
Yeah. Like you said, it's like an added layer of protection. It's like you not only have to know your social to file your return, but you also have to know this PIN number. And if you don't know the PIN number, if somebody has, you know, a PIN number, then they can't file like a fraudulent return under your name, right?
Yeah. Actually, this reminds me of when I froze my credit and then I was buying a van because I was pregnant and I forgot to unfreeze my credit. So I'm sitting in the dealership making phone calls because I didn't know my PIN. I didn't put it in LastPass.
Oh, no.
Like I froze it. I forgot that I was going to have to unfreeze it. So it took a couple of hours. But of course, you know, the salespeople were very patient because they were getting a nice sale. So they waited and I got it done. But that was a nightmare. So if you have any recovery PINs when you froze your password, just jot it down somewhere safe. Don't put it in your phone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, data security is so important these days. But what else when it comes to credit? I know credit cards, they also kind of advertise that they have protection when it comes to travel or like rental car, auto insurance kind of thing, or like some of those like insurances. Like, do you think you're missing out on any of that by not using credit?
I have been a consumer for longer than you've been alive, Megan.
Probably true, yes.
Or at least for some. Anytime I have a problem with a product, I go to the place I bought it from. Because almost all these places have a warranty. They have a return policy. They're going to take care of it. We have a double oven that came with this house. My wife's so ecstatic. And one day, this touchpad thing, it didn't have dials or buttons. It's got a touchpad like a screen. And it started throwing an error. And we couldn't use it. So we had to call a guy out here to check it. And of course, he's, oh, you got an error. It's throwing this error. We got to get you a new motherboard for an oven. Really? He orders it, comes out the next week, installs it. We think it's working. But then we push a button to turn off the lower oven light and it turns off the upper oven heat. And I'm like, wait a minute, this is all messed up.
Oh, no. Backwards.
We call our credit card company? No, we call the guy and say, hey, this isn't working right. He's like, well, let me look into it. And then he found out there's a whole back end programming. We weren't going to wait for a credit card company to refund us and reorder this new. It would have been a big mess. We got the guy to come out and fix it. And that's how I've been dealing with all these things since going just cash only.
And you probably have something on your existing like auto insurance policy for like rental cars, whatever car you're driving. Like it's that protection carries over to you. Is that right?
Yeah. It has nothing to do with a credit card. Yeah. I mean, you could buy travel insurance. It doesn't matter if you pay for it with a credit card or debit card. It's travel insurance. It has nothing to do with how you pay for it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, Steve. I think you've given some stuff for us to chew on and maybe some life changes we could consider.
Yeah, just consider. I mean, nobody's going to change their mind because they heard about this. Unless they're already encouraged to get off of this cycle of debt they might have been, you know, dancing with the past few years. And especially, we're recording this in December, people are spending a lot of money. We are spending a lot of money, which is scary. You know, I like that extra buffer, but we're not going into debt. And we know we won't have that what I call the Visa headache in January.
Yep.
So comforting.
Yeah. The stats don't lie. Like our credit card balances are much, much higher than they once were. The trend is going up and we're not even out of the end of this year yet, which like the last quarter of the year is, like you said, like a lot of people do rack up more debt for the holidays. So it's a mind shift, but I think it's a very positive mind shift. And I do have clients that I've personally advised like, hey, let's take all spending. Like, I know you use these as your spending cards, but let's take all spending off of these cards because you have a trend of not paying off the balance in full. And they continue to rack up debt that they're then rolling over to a 0% card, which that's a solution. But if they're not fixing the behavior, like this spending more than they're earning, then we're just going to be in this cycle of continuing to try to figure out how to pay off that debt that accumulated. And so I have advised folks do that. And sometimes these are the objections I'll get, like, well, what about the points? What about certain protections? And it's nice to know that, like, there are legitimate ways that you can build your credit, like you were talking about, without having to use the debt instruments. Because, like we've talked about on the prior episodes, it does require, traditionally, it would require you having debt or having these instruments to build your credit score, but there could be other ways. And I think that's really enlightening.
Yeah. So we just debunked all three of those myths.
Right. In one episode.
You don't have to have a credit score to live in the United States and get a mortgage, which that's the only thing I'd ever borrow for. You are protected if you have fraudulent activity on your debit card. And the third thing was the third one is the credit card points and those types of things. People like to get the points and the bonuses. Mm-hmm. But I would challenge you if you're like Megan and you pay off your card every single month, if you're like Sim, you pay off your card every single month, are you getting ahead? Sure. Could you be overspending? Studies say that you could be by 16%. Mm-hmm. So are you getting ahead or not? I don't know. That would be a balance sheet type of measurement that we're not going to go through here on the podcast, obviously.
Yeah.
But we've been able to save money on the incomes that we have in this household. I've never had over $100,000 take-home pay in my life. And yet we're able to qualify for this mortgage, solo income, self-employed, no credit score. So that's just encouragement that all the stuff we're hearing about, you have to challenge the thought and go the way that you want to go. And I have. And everything's been working out great. I mean, Megan, you've seen the view where I'm looking at from my studio.
Oh my gosh, I was just about to close that thought out. Like, that was a great way to close out this whole thought on like the credit versus not using traditional credit scores. But yeah, I look forward to logging into Facebook and seeing the pictures that Steve posts of his view. He has this beautiful mountainous view in Colorado. And it's like a small town that you've moved to as well, right? Like in kind of a rural area of Colorado. But like snow caps in the distance and the climate, you see the climate change. It's very different every day. Like, I thoroughly enjoy seeing your pictures every so often.
I do too.
I'm very happy for you.
Thank you. Yep. It's a dream come true.
Well, what's kind of hilarious is this was not the original topic that I asked Steve to talk to me about on a podcast episode. We were actually going to vent together about kind of a similar situation we had with taxes that he had heard me talk about on a prior episode where I got served a IRS notice CP 2000, and you had something similar, but not exactly the same, right?
Right, right. It was February 2022. I received a CP 2000 letter from the IRS saying, hey, you didn't report. It was like $20,000 of income. Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, no, I reported everything. I went back, double checked my figures. What had happened was, I had some clients that had sent a 1099 NEC, non-compensated employee. I forgot how it was. Anyway, it's basically telling the IRS that they had paid me this certain amount of money, but they reported it to my Social Security number. And I had other clients who sent it in and they reported it properly as my EIN, my tax ID number, which is my business. Mm-hmm. Well, the IRS saw the Social Security number ones that they're saying were not claimed, that I didn't claim one of my taxes. It was an 8-month battle back and forth to say, no, I did report it. I did report it. We finally figured it out and I was right. But man, what a mess.
Yeah.
And that was just the 1099 NECs. The 1099K, oh gosh, should we get into that now, Megan? I mean,
well,
this
let me
has
pause.
Been the bane of my existence. Yes.
So I know that, Sim, you're in the physician space a lot. I know in the dental space, there's also a lot of 1099 work that can happen for moonlighting or for working as a 1099 versus being an employee.
Yeah, there's different types of 1099s. The main ones you'll see are the 1099 NEC, which is non-employee compensation. You'll see 1099 MISC, which stands for miscellaneous. And then the 1099K, you really see that more with like someone who sells products. Mm-hmm. So like someone, for example, maybe like a naturopathic doctor who sells supplements, right? They use Venmo, PayPal a lot.
Like a physical product, you think? Or
yeah.
Could it be? Okay.
Gotcha. Could be like a physical product. Some people use it to like pay certain types of workers under the table, but it will still get reported.
Gotcha. Okay. And so we do run into this with clients where someone will ask, like, okay, should I just be a sole proprietor? Should I consider setting up an LLC? Should I consider paying myself as an S corp? Should I be an S corp? These are structuring type conversations that we'll have with clients and then in conjunction with the tax planner. So this can come up a lot. And I'm sure there are people on here who have had experience with this, or hopefully we're preventing some of this headache for the future. But the reporting, it matters. Sim, have you ever seen a case like this with some of your clients?
I haven't come across it, but it is something that I caution people about, because there is that question of, like, do I set up an LLC? Then I need to get an EIN. And I know this is maybe a bit of a hot take, but for a lot of my clients, I do recommend getting the LLC, even if it's not, like, quote unquote needed, because I think it's a nice idea to have a bit of separation from you and your business. Now, for a lot of physicians, it's very minimal protection because you still need malpractice insurance, right? The LLC doesn't cover those sorts of acts. But I do think that it's something to be aware of, because when you set up the LLC, you will need to get an EIN for that entity.
Yeah. And mechanically, like, when you're working contract work for a, let's say, a practice, you're going to be working one day a month, you know, over the course of the year. So not a lot, but you're working with this practice. And what are the documents that need to be submitted to tell that employer, Sim, like, hey, here's how you need to pay me?
First of all, make sure that they have your EIN and not your social. You'll want to give them the form W-9, which should have the actual taxpayer identification number that you want them to use for your business.
Yeah. And I'm reading it now. I'm looking at it now. So it has, like, the name of the entity / individual. So if you're an LLC, you could put whatever you called the LLC, right? And it could just be your name, like, you know, Megan McGuire LLC, whatever it is. Business name, you can list that if it's different from the above. And then you'd have to select the appropriate box for what classification you are. So are you a sole proprietor? Are you an S corporation? Are you a partnership? Are you an LLC? And then it goes on down below where it gives you an option to enter in your social or your employer identification number. And I think this is where I probably went wrong. I think what I did is I put my social on the W-9 versus my EIN number. And it was either because I wasn't thinking about it, or maybe I didn't have my EIN number at the time and I didn't think it mattered. But oh, it matters. You need to make sure if you're going to be reporting that income under your business or, like, through the business on your tax return, that it's not reported to you personally. So that, I think, we're going to be able to fix. My CPA is on it already. We've already submitted, like, you know, what we need to prove that it was an honest mistake. But yeah, I hope I don't have to pay that really gnarly tax bill, because it's something I already paid.
And that's almost exactly the same scenario I had. I had clients who had been sending in 1099s to the IRS saying they had paid me. I was also getting the third-party processing companies, you know, QuickBooks, Wave Apps, all those places, were sending the IRS information saying, hey, this client of yours was sending payment to you, and we have to report it to the IRS through his 1099K form. So I was getting double reported to the IRS through the system.
Ooh,
and that's the confusing thing, is the clients think they have to send a 1099 NEC to me, but they don't if they pay with a electronic type of payment, credit card, debit card, through an invoicing system through that third-party processing company. Because the third-party processing company is going to be sending the 1099
generates it
to the IRS and to me, saying, hey, you paid. No. Yeah. So instead of, we'll just use round numbers. Instead of me reporting $100,000 worth of income, 1099K sent the IRS saying I had $100,000. And then I had all these clients sending the IRS all these letters saying they paid me another 20. So the IRS said, oh, well, you made 120. No, that 20 was absorbed in that 1099K. It was a real mess to try and unravel.
Yeah.
Real mess.
Yeah.
And it's going to get more complicated now, because this law that they changed, the way the 1099Ks from these third-party processing systems, it's kind of weird, because they set the law back in, like, 2021. But then it came time where all these companies were supposed to send these 1099Ks out. That's PayPal. That's Venmo, I think.
Venmo.
That's all these
Cash App, yeah.
Yeah, all these places for anything $600 or more. So if somebody sends you $600 for anything, they're going to send a 1099K that may not actually be services rendered. And it may not be a contractor type thing.
It might be a personal account, not a business account.
Yeah. I mean, how many times do you get something from PayPal that might be over $600? If you sell something on Marketplace and they pay you via PayPal, it may not be that you provided a service or a product that was actually a sale. It was just you're selling your garage sale stuff. your motorcycle. You're
sending money to like your family for something.
Exactly.
Yeah. Or like splitting rent. Like that would have killed me because me and my now husband, like back in the day, would split rent and he would send me his half of the rent. And that would be horrible if I had to start paying income tax on that.
And yeah. So now you have to somehow prove that you aren't supposed to pay taxes on that.
Yeah.
Well, what's supposed to happen is a lot of these vendors like PayPal, they offer a personal account and a business account. Mm-hmm. So if you're running a business, you're selling goods and services as part of a business, you're supposed to use the business account. And then the personal transactions should not receive a 1099-K. Doesn't mean they won't do it anyway, because we know the implementation has been wonky, but that's how it's supposed to go.
Yeah. Or they give you the option to choose, like, is this a personal transaction or is this a business transaction?
Right.
I know Venmo does that. Yeah.
PayPal's supposed to do that too.
Let me just pull it up here real quick. I know this was an interesting like development because I'll be sending like my sister money for the play that we're about to go to. And it'll be like, is this a business request or is this a, let's see, let me just do 100.
Send it to Steve, Stuart, me.
Here we go. So it says on Venmo, it says turn on. So like when you get through the pay screen, you put it in like how much you're paying, what it's for, who the person it's going to. It pulls up like what bank do you want it to come from? It has this little button that you can turn on for purchases. And if you turn it on, Venmo, for example, will give you a full refund if an eligible purchase isn't what you paid for. The seller pays a small fee. So if I was sending you like $50 for concert tickets and I put that on there, it wouldn't send you $50. It'd send you like $47.50 because it takes seller fees from it. And then if I was mad at you, I could say, hey, I didn't actually go to the concert with this person and ask for a full refund from Venmo, even though that is not what I should be doing, right? That's illegal. That's wrong. But it is interesting how they've already set that up to where I'm sure it's tagging like any business transaction or like service that you're paying for, it's tagging that and it's going to be filtering that through to what they need to be sending a document for at the end of the year if it goes above that $600 threshold. But that changed though, right? It didn't, the threshold change for 2025?
Well, they're doing a phase in. So for this year, it's $5,000 for 2024. For 2025, it's $2,500. And then it goes to $600 in 2026, unless they change it again.
Yeah.
Gotcha. And that just means that they won't send the document if it's under that amount. Is that correct?
Correct.
Gotcha.
Right. So that's the reporting threshold.
Is it still technically your responsibility to report it, though, as long as it's over 600?
That's always true. You always have your, like, no matter what, like if someone makes a mistake with your tax forms, you are still, like when you sign your tax return, you're saying that everything in there is true and accurate at the risk of perjury.
Gotcha. Okay. So if they were to do an audit and take a look at, oh, actually, you sold, for this year, for example, $4,500 worth of products and services, you never reported that as income. So even though you didn't get the tax document from Venmo or PayPal or whatever service or portal you used, you could get audited and it could still come back on you for lying, basically perjuring yourself.
Well, here's an example. Like, you are required to pay self-employment tax if you earn net self-employment of $400 or more, which is below the reporting threshold, right, for a lot of these companies that are paying you. So like if you earn, for example, like the $600 reporting threshold that's going to exist, but you earn less than that, maybe you earned like $400 or $500 as a self-employed person, you still have to pay tax on that. So you still have to self-report it, even if you don't get a 1099.
Mm-hmm. I have an interesting story, and I know we're going to wrap up here. So NCAA, players for school, like collegiate ball players, historically, they have not been paid. Now that's changed. You can get paid as a collegiate player for sponsorships or things. So interestingly, there's a game. There's like a video game that my husband plays. I think it's called NCAA something. To be a player in the game. So let's say you're Travis Hunter and they're creating this football video game. They want to make a player out of you, like make it look like you in the game. Well, you can get paid to be a player in the game. They have to pay you for like rights to have you as a player. Guess how much they pay to be a player in these games? $600 or less, because that's they don't have to send the reporting stuff if they're paying less than $600, right? So it's probably making it easier for them. They're kind of checking the box where, yeah, they were paid, to be in this video game, but we're not going to pay enough to where we have to generate all this extra need to send out these reports and them have to pay taxes on this stuff. Or, technically they have to pay taxes, but So I thought that was interesting. When my husband was telling me about this, I was like, I know why. They're it's lobbying. $600.
They're lobbying to make the law.
Right.
Anything over 600 reported, but at this number, forget it.
Yeah. So this is something that I thought was kind of a beware topic, like just talking through like reporting. You know, if you have some 1099 income, some side income, some service income, one, you need to make sure it's reported correctly or the IRS is going to come back at you if it's not reconciling. And two, we need to make sure we're prepared for what's to come with this change in the law with reporting requirements from these vendors like Venmo, Cash App, PayPal, all that. Because if we're also not keeping record of what is actually a business sale and what's personal, like it might also come back to bite us. And then, you know, just kind of the last little thing I was going to mention here is just make sure to list out all the income sources that you could have in a tax year. That sounds kind of silly, especially if you just have one income source, like you're fine. But if you've got a couple different practices that you're working for or a couple different businesses that you've done activities for, you need to make sure that you're looking out for tax documents that you could receive for them and accounts. High yield savings account is going to generate a 1099 INT for you. Same thing with your brokerage account. If you had some taxable growth or a loss, they're going to generate a tax document for you. If you did a backdoor Roth conversion, you're going to have some tax documents. So you need to list out everything that you could potentially get some kind of tax document from, your health insurance if you're 1099, and make sure that these are all accounted for before you file taxes. I know a lot of people are eager to get taxes filed as soon as possible.
File an extension.
Yeah. So if you're waiting.
This is my other hot take. Most yeah. people should file an extension for this very reason, because you forget one or two documents and you have to amend the return.
You have to amend the whole return.
Yeah.
Exactly. I'm going to have to amend my whole 2022 return anyways, because that was the biggest part of that CP2000 notice that I got. Me and my husband got married that year, and there was one account that we used the funds. It was a brokerage account. We used all the money from, you know, the year prior to purchase our home. And we thought we had closed it all out, but it had like $10 left in it that generated some kind of document for me that we didn't report. So I've got to still amend my return for that tiny document that we missed out on. So very important to stay organized, to know who's going to be sending you tax documents. And like Sim said, could make sense to extend your return to make sure you've got everything before you file, or else you might have to amend your return, which is timely, can be expensive. So just some hot takes and some notes before we're closing out the tax year, right?
Man, the listeners are just like, what else can go wrong here? So if I summarize everything that I've been hearing here, you're saying, we're all saying, this is all confusing.
Yeah.
So we empathize. We should all keep our own records.
Yes.
Stay organized and keep our own records. And then stay subscribed to the Student Loan Planner podcast. Get all the updates as we need them. Right? And yeah. I'm going to say, pay attention, not interest.
Oh, I love that.
Pay attention, not interest. I love that. That's a great closing line. Oh,
thank you, Steve.
Thank you so much for joining us today. I think this was a blast, and hopefully you have fun editing this episode since it's you, you know?
Absolutely.
He
will.
Said, sorry, Steve, to himself a couple times for the listeners who won't hear it. But appreciate you, and I hope everybody has a great weekend coming up, and we will catch you on the next one.
What if you could get fiduciary financial planning specific to your profession that's student loan aware that could change your life for a price much better than you ever dreamed possible? If that sounds good to you, go to slpwealth.com/pod for a free, no obligation 15-minute intro call with one of our own fiduciary financial planners to see if we could be a good fit for you. This podcast is for informational, educational, and entertainment purposes only and should not be considered individualized investment advice. If a specific investment is mentioned, do not consider it a recommendation to buy or sell the investment. Seek first advice from a financial professional before implementing any strategies discussed. All investments involve risk, and past performance does not guarantee future results. Yay, compliance.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to the Student Loan Planner podcast episode. I'm going to restart.
Sorry, Steve.
Take that out, Steve.
All right.